I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is March 1st, 2022. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll.
Chair Hansen is present. Vice Chair Wasilewicz.
Wasilewicz, present.
Lead Heinzman.
Present.
Representative Acomb.
Present.
Representative Ackland. Representative Ackland. Representative Backer.
Backer, present.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Becker-Finn, present.
Representative Eklund.
Eklund, present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Representative Green.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Igo, present.
Representative Jordan.
Jordan, present.
Representative Keeler.
Keeler, present.
Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Lipper.
Present.
Representative Lewick.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Representative Nelson.
Nelson, present.
Representative Tice.
Tice, present.
All right. One more time, Representative Ackland. All right. Thank you.
The quorum is present. Representative Ackland, would you like to move the minutes for February 24th?
I'll move the minutes for February 24th, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ackland moves the minutes for February 24th, 2022. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. First up, Representative Ackland has House File 3726, the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Representative Ackland, would you like to move that House File 3726 be recommended be re-referred to the Legacy Finance Committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move that House File 3726 be recommended be re-referred to the Legacy Finance Committee.
Thank you. We have about 40 minutes scheduled for this bill. Representative Ackland, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Environment Committee. The Lassard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council is in its 14th year, and we're recommending a total of 46 programs be funded by the Minnesota Legislature for a total of $155,361,000. In this bill, 80,929 acres of wildlife habitat throughout Minnesota is estimated to be restored, enhanced, and or protected. 127 miles of shoreline will be restored, enhanced, and or protected as well. An additional $33,370,000 in federal, state, and private conservation funding is expected to be leveraged with the fiscal year 2023 Outdoor Heritage Fund. 29 different organizations are recommended for funding, 2 state agencies, 9 local units of government, and 18 non-government organizations. Continued investment in ongoing robust programs constitutes 90% of the programs recommended. Activities include native prairie protection, wetland restoration, trout stream enhancement, public wildlife enhancements, shallow lake enhancement, forest fragmentation prevention, strategic land acquisition, and fee and conservation easements. So, Mr. Chair and members, I have several testifiers here to talk about more details and the merits of the bill.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name and who you're with for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Mark Johnson. I'm the executive director of the Lassard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. And also with us today is Joe Pavelko, the assistant director for the Lassard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. Mr. Chair, as you and the members have heard, Representative Ackland has provided the highlights of the bill from a, and those are all provided in this handout. Well, I've got the handout that was provided to you by staff. Sorry for my background making this thing go off. But the so Mr. Pavelko and I will provide you a little more of an overview of the bill now, if that would be fine. First of all, Mr. Chair, members, the council, the Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, goes through a rather arduous process each year, for quite a lengthy process, where a call for funding is put out in beginning of April through the end of May, and then the council starts looking at those proposals, each one of them. And members of this committee, you should be aware that you have two members currently right now from this committee who sit on the Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. One is Representative Eklund and the other is Representative Heinzman. You are also extra lucky because you have two alumni of the council who sit on this. And one is Chair Hansen and the other is Representative Becker Finn. So a lot of institutional knowledge, a lot of knowledge on how the process works with the council is at your fingertips or at, just at your asking of your own members. The this bill is a culmination of that year-long process or many month-long process of the council. And as you heard, it's about $155 million in funding requests. The council, as it looks at this, although the council is bipartisan and nonpartisan, so for those new members here, there are 12 council members, four of them are legislators, eight of them are citizens that are appointed either by the governor or the legislature, one body or the other. The four legislators are one minority party and one majority party member from each of the House and the Senate. So that's why we say it's bipartisan. The council, though, very much acts in a nonpartisan manner, and they are very proud of that, as I'm sure your members will attest to you. The proposals, as I mentioned, come in the spring through the summer. The council members look at each one of them and vet those, and they actually rank them based on set criteria. Then there's much discussion amongst the council members on why they ranked them at such and such. Then there are hearings that happen for each one of the proposals coming in and testifying and arguing their case as to why their project should or should not should be funded and for what amounts. And then ultimately, in December, the council produces this recommendation, which comes together in the bill that we have before us. And that recommendation, in this case, this year, as in virtually every year, is a unanimous culmination of the council. It's a unanimous vote of the council. That doesn't mean that every council member agrees with every other council member on which project is the most important, nor how they should rank them. But it does mean that in the end, the council comes together with a consensus review and proposal or recommendation set that they then present to the legislature, which we have in front of us now. The I will draw your attention to the last page, the last side, the back side of this brochure. It looks like this. I think you can see it a little bit there. And On that page, what you'll notice is it shows all of the different proposals that are recommended for funding, who is recommended for receiving the funds, or in other words, who's involved in the project, and then how much the funding amount is. The list as it is presented on this backside of the recommendation summary is exactly the same as it is presented in the bill. So as you see in the upper left-hand corner, it says subdivision 2 prairies. That's tough to do. But underneath prairies, there are 9 different projects in the bill, just as in this summary and in the same order. So you can see exactly what's there. Subdivision 3 is forest. Subdivision 4 is wetlands, followed by subdivision 5, which is habitats. And then at the very end of the bill is subdivision 6, which is administration. The interesting thing about this is that you look at this outline of what projects there are and who the recipients potentially are, you'll see many local government units that are represented, such as the City of Rogers or the Morrison County Soil and Water Conservation District. The Dakota County, Washington County is in there. The Mississippi Headwaters Joint Powers Board is in there. Et cetera. You'll also see that there are a lot of non-government organizations or NGOs listed. And those are, you know, some of the typicals you would think of, like Pheasants Forever, the Nature Conservancy, Ducks Unlimited, the Minnesota Land Trust, but also others like the Lower Phalen Creek Project or the Audubon, Minnesota or Minnesota Trout Unlimited, and more. There are only two government agencies that are, two state agencies that are represented. One is Bowser, and I think they're involved with about six different proposals within this listing. Those are very much RIM or CREP oriented type proposals. Most of them, they may be doing them by themselves, just Bowser with Bowser staff, or they may be incorporating other entities along with them, local government units or even NGOs. And likewise, the DNR, I think, is on eight of these proposals, again, either doing it by themselves or in concert with another entity such as an NGO. Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Pavelko. Okay.
Mr. Pavelko, welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Joe Pavelko, Assistant Director with LaSard SAM staff. I'd like to call your attention to the middle part of the brochure with the graphs. On the left side, it's got output by acres, and on the right side, it's got output by funding. And we try and use this page here as just a way to try and make sense of all the high dollar amounts and all of the acres to tell more of a story. So on the left side, when we talk about acres, the LaSard Council breaks things up by restore, protect and fee with PILT, protect and fee without PILT, protect and enhance in easement, and then enhance. So restore is taking something that habitat that's not there and bringing it back. So that would be going from, say, a field where there's nothing there back to prairie or a field to back to a wetland. Protect and fee with PILT, that's where land is acquired in fee and given to the DNR where they actually have PILT payments for those properties. Protect and fee without PILT would be anything that's not going to the DNR that does not have a PILT payment. So that could be going to the federal government, counties, NGOs, anywhere where there's not an actual PILT payment to the DNR or from the DNR. Protect and easement, those are all perpetual conservation easements. The two big players with OHF funding are Bowser for the RIM easements, Dakota County oftentimes, and of course, Minnesota Land Trust, they have private conservation easements. And Enhance, which is the largest acreage category for OHF, that's taking land that's existing habitat and making it better. So it might be taking grassland that has trees on it and removing the trees to make a better grassland habitat. And when you look down below the graph there, you'll see it's broken into acres by ecological section. And if you want, you can take the colors and walk it all through the left and right side. So if you want to look for enhanced acres, just look for the lighter blue and you can follow that through and see how it all plays out. And then on the bottom, there's resource type by acres. And this is helpful because resources are not necessarily in the actual ecological section. So there could be wetlands that are being restored in the northern forest, and the project managers won't say that they're doing forests in the northern forest if they're actually doing wetlands. So it's just a different way to tell the story. And then on the right side, output by funding. This goes to show that some of the activities cost more than others. So if you look on the left side, the output by acres, 62% of the acres are enhanced. And you look to the right, it's actually only 18% of the funding. So it just gives you an idea of what costs, what the average costs are per acre. And the same with distribution of funds by ecological section, just shows how much things cost in different areas. And then one thing that we try and look for after we get a compilation of all the dollars and acres is trying to find any anomalies. And this year, one thing that I did find is that the metro urban, the total amount of money being spent in the metro urban ecological section is about 18%. And the range that is we've had over the years from inception has been 2.9 to about 16%. And so this year, about 18% of the money has been in the has been recommended for the metro urban, and that's mainly due to that large project in St. Paul. So if there are any further questions on how this all breaks out, or if members want, you know, different information or more specific information, we've got it all on our fingertips. All of the project information is all in an online database, so it's pretty easy to get. We just need to, if you're looking for something, we can get it.
Members, we do have one more testifier, so I'd like to get Mr. Carlson through before we start. So, Mr. Carlson, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, fellow committee members. I'm Dave Carlson. I'm the president of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, here to support House File 3726. I want to thank Representative Eklund and eight co-authors for carrying this important legislation. LOHA represents over 50 diverse hunting and conservation organizations in Minnesota, and our member groups support the work of Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council and their annual recommendations to the legislature for fund allocations. It is important to MOHA that no changes are made to the recommendations so that they will benefit all Minnesotans and our conservation legacy. These dedicated funds are important to the sportsmen and sportswomen of Minnesota. The citizens of Minnesota benefit from these dedicated funds by the work of these organizations and the Minnesota DNR, and they are able to do work that otherwise would not be funded, from restoration to preservation of our public lands. Partnering with groups dedicated to prairies, wetlands, streams, and clean water, the Outdoor Heritage Fund makes it all possible. I want to conclude with thanking those members of Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council for their work, their dedication, and their time to evaluate the many requests that come to them and to make the decisions to fund worthy projects that the sportsmen and sportswomen of Minnesota fully support. Minnesota is lucky to have all those that participate in helping to conserve our public lands and waters through the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So we support House File 3726. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple of comments and then a question. I'll start with the question. There was a bit of a discussion over the course of this last year as we were going through the projects coming to this subject area of cases in which purchases could be, or offers could be made 10% above their appraised value. And I know it's very rare, but I was hoping that Director Johnson could kind of go through how that works and help us better understand where that would be applied.
Director Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heinzman, thanks for asking that question. We did have a good discussion on that this year. What happens is in law, the DNR is restricted to purchase properties for no more than appraised value unless they have some excess funds from other savings, and then they can purchase for up to 10% over the appraised value of the property. With that in mind, we looked at, and it was some other questions behind it too, we looked at what is everybody doing just to verify. So we contacted the NGOs and we contacted the other government agencies or local government units. It all revolved around, this whole discussion really revolved around one local government unit saying, you know, in our area, we may have to do something different. And they were looking for the possibility of paying more than appraised value for some properties, potentially. They weren't sure if that was going to happen or not. But back to the issue with regards to what we found out, the NGOs don't buy for more than appraised value. They go appraised value or less. And the reason is they have other constraints. If they're a land trust, they have national accreditation issues that they have to adhere to. Same thing with NGOs. They have national accreditations. And also, as an NGO, if they pay a landowner more than appraised value, then there's a potential to get in some IRS problems with them because they're providing someone more than the value of a property with contributed or other funds. So NGOs stick to that appraised value or less also. In the case of, as this situation developed, it was Dakota County, and within that, Dakota County is going to be using, it was specifically regarding easement acquisitions. Dakota County, it's their appropriation recommendation in this bill, and what they're looking at doing is the answer to it all was that they're going to use a RIM style, they're going to mimic what Bowser does with RIM for their what they pay for easements, so that we actually have a, so that they actually have a very well processed, set out a way of purchasing those easements or offering the and figure out the values of those easements. I hope that answers your question, sir. Maybe there's something else you wished as well.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, Director Johnson, I didn't really get at the mechanisms where the 10% above assessed value is allowed. You did mention a few of the constraints around the organizations that live within the assessed value. And there have been a few cases, and I'll just mention it for the public record, where the assessment was massively incorrect. And one of those, if people want to check into it a little bit, is Mississippi Northwoods in my neck of the woods. And we're talking about millions of dollars out of line with actual value. So those are some things that I hope continue to be on our radar going forward. And during our time this last year working on the proposed package being brought today, I highlighted some concerns that I have with the rank and file membership of many of the NGOs. And for those not keeping track, that would be some terrific organizations like Ducks Unlimited and Minnesota Deer Hunters Association and Pheasants Forever, and I could go on and on. These groups are really trying hard to build a opportunity that might not exist for everyone or to enhance that opportunity. And here again, just for the public record, people should know the process, because it's not easy to understand sometimes that when we have groups come in and negotiate for a property that may not even come up on the market, it may be something that happens through that assessment and such, and then a deal is struck, which could be a great opportunity. I'm not disputing that. I'm just pointing out that, you know, for example, Pheasants Forever or Ducks Unlimited, they don't hold that property going forward. At some point, once our expectations are fulfilled for its highest and best use as per their organization's guidelines or whatever those guidelines might be, more often than not, that's handed over to DNR, to the state of Minnesota. I hope that people understand that process, because there are cases where the membership of some of these organizations have expectations that haven't been met. And I want people to know that I'm focused in on that and wanting to make sure that management is absolutely where their expectations are. And we have some work to do, because not all of these properties that are being acquired have the same management level being applied for their membership and for the public's access. And it shouldn't be taken as some kind of harsh criticism. It should be taken as a challenge to us as legislators and as folks involved in this process to make sure that we rise to the occasion and make sure that management, and by management, I mean providing the opportunities for hunters specifically, you know, these organizations are driven by hunting and that opportunity, but other uses as well. And that has to be closely considered before we just continue forward buying more and more acres across the state of Minnesota. It needs to not only be a situation where we're just buying land, but also managing it for its highest and best use for hunting, because that's what it was advertised as in many cases. by these organizations who come to Lazard Sam's asking for support for these particular purchases. So I just wanted to highlight that and bring some attention to it so people know this is the process, and that hopefully this is something that we can focus on going forward more closely. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to make that comment.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have, I'm going to make a comment first, and then I've got some questions for Director Johnson or the other testifier, if that's all right. You know, they pointed out on the pie charts, these are really good pie charts, and this is always good information, but with the amount of land that Minnesota already has, and my numbers, I will tell you, are from like 2011, which is the last real update that I've been able to get on how much land Minnesota how much land is actually in the public domain in Minnesota. And it's very close to a third just on those old numbers. And yet we have $155 million here, and we should be looking at the best use for that. And although I appreciate the Lazard Sam's Council, we are the final say in that. And so if there is problems there, we should be looking into that. And so just for example, you know, we've got 11% of the acreage here that's being purchased, and it's still a substantial amount. It's over 8 million acres, or 8,000 acres. But anyway, 8,000 acres. And then we also have 18,000 in easements. So we're looking at 27,000 roughly acres in that's going to be taken out of production. And that 11% of those acreage take up 32% of this money. Whereas on the other hand, we've got 62% of enhancements. And if you look at the enhancements, we're only looking at 18% of the money. And so with all the land that we have out there, there's just a lot of angst out here, for lack of a better word, as to why we continue to buy more. And I do want to hit some on the NGOs as well. And there will be a question here, but basically on the NGOs, as was stated by Representative Heinzman, I don't know that they ever keep the land. And so they will buy the land with tax dollars. They will do whatever work that they have to do on it, mostly with tax dollars in some forms of grants. And then they turn it back over to the state, and there's no money there, unless we put it there with tax dollars to continue the ongoing maintenance of that land. And so we see more and more property that isn't being maintained. And so one of the questions that I have for Mr. Johnson is how many of the NGOs in the projects actually keep the land, or do they all turn it back to some other entity?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, thanks for asking that question. Of the NGOs that come to mind, I believe it's just one NGO that we have that acquires property and holds it, and also and that is the Nature Conservancy. And then when they do that, they also pay the property tax on that land moving forward. That's part of their pledge. It's part of their accomplishment plan and part of their deal with the council, so to speak, as part of their proposal. Unless Mr. Pavelko can remember any others, I think that's the only one, sir.
Representative Green.
Thank you. Thank you for that. That's what I believe is true, too. But I also think that the Nature Conservancy is also a lot of times back looking for more grants and other funds to keep themselves going. So in the long run, the taxpayers are losing this property from private, their ability to purchase it privately, but then they're also on the hook for maintaining it as well. But the other questions are something that I've been looking up in some of the reference books and also hearing from out here in my area. And I know you and I talked a little bit about this, Director Johnson, about the use of these funds when there's land being taken by eminent domain. And it's pretty specific within the legacy amendment that you can't do that. And yet, you know, there's some card games going on where they're saying, well, we're not really using the money for the eminent domain, that's somewhere else, and we're using the legacy funds for something else within that project. And I'm not buying that. And I'm wondering, is there anything that you guys do, short of someone bringing this forward to you, do you look into these projects ever and go back and see how this money was used and if it was used properly?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, good questions. Thank you. Yes, we do go back and look, and actually in the bill you'll see that there's a technical review panel appropriation that happens each year. It's for a couple hundred thousand dollars, I think it is, and that is specifically based on statute to go back and look at the enhancements and restorations and are they done correct? Is the money being spent correct? That's done somewhat on a random basis, but also if we have any hot buttons, we can talk to the review panel, to the technical review committee, and they will actually go out and look at those projects as well in their group of 25 or whatever it is they do each year. From an eminent domain standpoint, statute allows for eminent domain to be used only with outdoor heritage funds only when it's at the request of the seller, and that's for land that's acquired, and that's really for their tax purposes. Very, very seldom happens. I don't know if I remember ever it happening with outdoor heritage, but you know, it's the possibility because it's left there in statute. Otherwise, other eminent domain, I think you're probably referring to the one out the Goose Prairie Marsh Enhancement, that's a WMA out in western Minnesota. And that's one where we've been very straightforward with the watershed district saying that in no way can the outdoor heritage funds be used for eminent domain. The outdoor heritage funds in that at that case were being used, are being used for a water control structure that's for a new outlet with that water control structure so that it can be used for habitat purposes, but also to mitigate some downstream flood problems as well.
Representative Green, last question.
Well, the last question is going to be a long one. Thank you for that answer. But I think that, you know, we get back to the card game as to the money's going in there. And I do know that they passed a resolution out there. So the last question is, in the 2018 five-year plan on water management areas, the DNR on page 5 of that talks about how they are no longer seeking funds from, I believe it's the Environmental Trust Fund, because now they're getting their funds from Legacy. And I'm wondering how that corresponds with the supplanting of these funds into projects where at one time they were funded by something else. And if you ever look into that.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Green, I'm not aware of that, tell you the truth. We can look into it. If they were previously getting funds from the Environmental Trust Fund and now they're looking at getting funds from Outdoor Heritage Funds, I'm not aware of that, but I can look into that. Mr. Pavelko may know more. I don't know.
So, maybe we can talk later.
Sure.
Thank you, Representative, not Mr., but Representative Green. Representative Wasluwick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. My first one is, I noted the handout said that 90% of the recommendations are for ongoing programs. I'm wondering, Mr. Johnson or our other testifier, if you can talk about like what percentage of the actual projects that the council considered were new programs or projects as opposed to the ongoing programs that were funded.
Mr. Johnson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Wasluwick, thank you for that question. There are six new proposals within this recommendations plan, and those are the others are all repeats or extended phases of, as the council would say, robust and projects that are programs that are doing well. Each of the programs, it should also be noticed, is each of the programs has multiple projects within it. There are very few which are really pigeonholed. One that's pigeonholed, a new one this year, is the Big Woods Protection at Steeg Woods, which is underneath the Subdivision 3 and Forests. And it's the City of Rogers, where they just specifically want to purchase one piece of woods for protection and city use. There's a new Bowser one. There's a new one for Washington County, and DNR even has a new one this year and in a couple more. I believe we had five projects that were not recommended for funding this year. Of those, I believe, one was a repeat project another phase, which the council had requested that they kind of finish up some more spending and then they come back next year. They're doing great work. It's just, you know, they wanted to see some more of the funding finished up. I believe of the other four, I think at least three, if not all four of them, three of them at least, were referred to CPL because they were first, they could be broken up into smaller portions. They maybe only had part of their request that they felt like they were ready for on the ground work. One was down in Lakeville. They already have applied for CPL, I know, and I don't know if they've been successful yet, but I believe they were very favorable in the review. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Wadsworth.
Yes, that does. Thank you. My other question, and this may be a thing we have to follow up on given time constraints, but I'm wondering sort of what thought goes into climate impact. So if we have projects that are that we have state funds going towards, and then like a flood wipes one of them out, or a storm comes, or those sorts of things, what sort of consideration is given, knowing what we know about climate and how it's already impacting our state, what sort of consideration is given to funding those projects? And then if there is a climate, some sort of disaster that sort of puts everything back, what sort of process is in place to sort of address those concerns?
Dr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wozniak, again, great question. Thanks for asking it. We always run into there's always an opportunity to run into a problem because of weather or because of climate change, what we call climate change or impacts. For instance, with stream enhancement, when we have these high water impacts that are high rains and so on, they just raise havoc with what's been done, any fresh work that's been done along the stream side. And in those cases, in every case, the contractor is actually part of the contract is they're responsible to come back and fix that and, you know, renew that. And they do. There's always a project manager that's out looking at the sites and making sure the work is done properly and to specifications and that it stays intact. The same can happen with drought and everything else. Part of the things that are being done, like in the prairie, where we're looking at grassland or prairie enhancement, is we're looking at local ecotypes of that are not just indigenous, local ecotypes of plants that are not just indigenous to the area, but are resistant to those types of resilient in those types of climates. And at the Legacy Committee 2 weeks ago, I think it was, we had a really good presentation on behalf of LSOHC by Greg Hoke talking about some of those considerations. TNC has also is wonderful at being able to articulate how those enhancements are being accentuated by making sure that we're taking those things into consideration.
Representative Becker-Finn, and before Representative Becker-Finn starts, I want to acknowledge her participation in developing these recommendations. I think that might have got missed a little bit, but thank you for your work on the council and developing these recommendations and your insight. Representative Becker-Finn.
Yep, thank you, Chair Hansen. And to that, I had stepped down from the council in January, and Representative Eklund was appointed. But yes, I was the person who reviewed, rated, vetted, and listened to all these projects. But forces beyond my control prefer that somebody else carry the bill. And so, this is not at all a critique of Representative Eklund. He's a great member of our team in this committee, but would have preferred that the person who reviewed the projects bring this forward, but I'm not at all those tables where all those decisions are made. So I do want to state that for the record. And I think to Representative Wozniak's question about new projects, despite it being a nonpartisan council, sometimes politics does impact the work that we do on the council. And one new project that did come up this year, I was bordered the boundary waters. And politics got in the way of that being included in this project, despite, you know, the benefits that it would bring as a project as far as what we are tasked with on the council, which is laid out in the Constitution with the amendment. I also want to say, you know, just overall, this is a good bill. There's a lot of good projects in it, but it could definitely be a better bill. And part of that is that, you know, what the council and the work that it funds does, there is definitely room for improvement. And I think that we had a little bit, you know, broader discussion of this last session, but the way that the council and those who surround and work around the council is still overwhelmingly white and male. And that's just a fact. And I'm sure that, you know, it's hard for some people to face those facts, but that is the reality. There still are many communities and many people who are not necessarily welcome in those rooms and may not feel welcome to be part of the work that the council does. And I just think it's really important that we say that and we talk about that and sort of lift that up in this committee, because these funds are a percentage of the sales tax that we all pay as Minnesotans. These funds belong to all of us. These projects belong to all of us, not just the folks who are in those rooms and at those tables, and not just the folks who are used to getting these funds. This is money that's supposed to benefit all Minnesotans, and I think we have to remember that moving forward. And I know that Representative Eklund knows that as well, and will bring that forward during his time on the council. And I do want to thank him for stepping up to be on the council. And so I just wanted to bring that up. I think it's important that we recognize that. And I just wanted to, you know, state publicly that, you know, it was my choice to step down from the council, but I had offered to carry the bill and, you know, happy to answer questions about the projects if folks do have them. But overall, it's a good bill, and we'll look forward to supporting it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Was there a question in that, Representative Becker-Finn?
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, not necessarily a question, but I think it is really important that it's not enough to sort of ask folks to check a box saying they care about diversity and bringing more people to the table. And I do hope that even if my voice is not on the council anymore, that work will be continued by others on the council. So not a question, but thank you, Chair Hansen.
I have a couple of quick questions before we vote. First up, you know, there's not many of us left in the legislature who were here when we debated the constitutional amendment. And I want to reference and acknowledge the work of the late Representative Frank Moe, who literally ran the amendment from conference committee up to the front desk. And I've been thinking about that, you know, and that the evolution of what people think the constitutional amendment is and how with certainty people say what it is. And it is that the funds may be spent only to restore, protect, enhance wetlands, prairies, forest, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. So there is a value of protecting a wetland for a wetland's sake. There is a value of protecting, restoring, enhancing a prairie for the prairie's sake. There is a value of protecting, restoring, enhancing the forest for the forest's sake, not for how we use it or how we enjoy it, but for its part in this ecosystem that we are part of. We also focus a lot, or there's mention of the word habitat, and we heard today about hunting. Habitat for fish, and there hasn't been a lot in terms of a percentage of fish work. It's hard because our lakes are public waters. But when the amendment was brought before the people, the memory and the vision that I remember was a kid jumping off a dock into the lake. That was the commercial that made the sale. And that was acknowledged by an actual scientific poll after the Constitution Amendment was passed, and that clean water was primarily the main reason why people voted for the Constitutional Amendment. Habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. Wildlife. So not just things that we hunt and fish, but the little things, the pollinators, the critters we don't like. They're all part of this web that we're part of. And so that investment in 2008 and that work that was done often is forgotten in terms of the language. And we always have to come back to that language. We only have a limited time left of the constitutional amendment. And so rather than looking at acres or the enjoyment, we're going to have to look at the accomplishments, the outcomes. What did we achieve? How have we made our state better with this? And how did we restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife? My question, Mr. Johnson, is you referenced the restoration evaluations, and that was the check to make sure that what we are funding actually is being done. And I know some years ago with that, originally that was fought. There were people who did not want restoration evaluations. And after it was implemented, there seemed to be more enhancements rather than restoration. So first off, do the restoration evaluations, do they include enhancements as well as just restorations?
Mr. Chair, yes. They're doing both enhancements as well as restorations now.
And Mr. Johnson, it's my memory that we have up to 1% of the recommendations must be spent on restoration evaluations. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I can check the statute. You caught me off guard. What popped into my mind was at least 99% of the funds must be used for the project. In other words, only 1% can be used otherwise for administration and technical evaluations, et cetera.
So if, Mr. Johnson, if our amount that increases each year, I would hope the amount appropriated for the evaluations increases as well and not is kept at a static level. I don't know the answer to that, so if you can get back to me on that. And then we've got a few years left on this. And the reason this comes to the Environment Committee is that this, when it was passed, we didn't have a legacy committee. So our effort on looking at this has been part of the tradition. I appreciate Chair Lilly's patience. We haven't sent this to him yet, but we are about to now. So with that, unless there are any other questions, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first off, Representative Becker Finn, thank you for all the help on this. I know you're going to be a valuable asset to me going forward as we move this bill the rest of the way through the session. And I can assure you that diversity issues are something that are very prominent on my mind. Minnesota has an outstanding record of doing everything it can to help preserve our outdoor heritage. This is a good bill for protecting and preserving our environment. And Mr. Chair, members, I ask for support as we move this bill forward. I'll renew my motion.
Representative Eklund renews his motion that House File 3726 be recommended to be re-referred to the Legacy Finance Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. Vice Chair Wasilewicz?
Wasilewicz, aye.
Wasilewicz votes aye. Representative Heintzman?
Aye.
Heintzman votes aye. Representative Acomb?
Aye.
Acomb votes aye. Representative Eklund?
Eklund, aye.
Eklund votes aye. Representative Backer?
Backer votes aye.
Backer votes aye. Representative Becker Finn?
Aye.
Becker Finn votes aye. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund votes aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher votes aye. Representative Green?
No.
Green votes no. Representative Igo?
Igo, aye.
Igo votes aye. Representative Jordan?
Jordan, aye.
Jordan votes aye. Representative Keeler? Representative Keeler? Representative Lee?
Lee, aye.
Lee votes aye. Representative Lippert?
Lippert, aye.
Lippert votes aye. Representative Lewick?
Lewick votes aye.
Lewick votes aye. Representative Morrison?
Morrison, aye.
Morrison votes aye. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson votes aye. Representative Tice?
Tice, aye.
Tice votes aye. And checking one more time for Representative Keeler. All right. Mr. Chair, the vote is 17 ayes, one nay.
The motion prevails. On its way to legacy. Next up is House File 2814, also by Representative Eklund. It's Representative Eklund Day here. Farm Survey Owner Requirements Modified. Representative Eklund, would you like to move that House File 2814 be laid over?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move that House File 2814 be laid over.
Representative Eklund, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. House File 2814 is a pretty simple bill. We now have technology available to live test animals, farm survey for chronic wasting disease. Minnesota goes to great lengths and takes all precautions in protecting our meat and food supply, and the RT Quick Test is one more tool that we have available to protect the industry. There are approximately 3,500 captive whitetail in the state, and this bill appropriates $250,000 to the Board of Animal Health to live test all captive whitetails in the state. This will tell us if there is or is not a CWD or CWD in a farm survey in the state. If we find that there is not a CWD issue in our farm survey industry, that would be fine. If we do find problems through the use of this technology, then we would know the areas of the state that would need the most attention. Today, I have a few testifiers for and against the bill, Mr. Chair, and I will stand for questions.
First up, John Zanmiller, Blufflin's Whitetail Associations. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Zanmiller. I'm the Director of Community and Governmental Relations for Bluffland Whitetails. Bluffland Whitetails represents farmers, hunters, landowners, and conservationists throughout southeast Minnesota and beyond in preserving, promoting, and enhancing Minnesota's wild white-tailed deer herd. We speak in favor of Representative Eklund's bill because we believe that it will do wonders for preserving and protecting that wild herd. That's important not only for our financial well-being as a state, but in preserving Minnesota's rich hunting tradition and family gathering time together. There have been concerns raised about the bill, specifically towards whether or not RT Quick is an effective method of testing. Our organization believes that, in fact, it does. RT Quick is used in the diagnosis and understanding of the human form of chronic wasting disease, Creutzfeldt-Jakob. And increasingly, we're seeing more and more peer-reviewed studies that support RT Quick. In addition to that, a recent administrative law hearing in St. Paul found that RT Quick was a valid test to be considered in decision making. We believe that this will go a long way in preserving the health of our wild herd by ensuring that captive herds that are transported throughout our state are regularly tested to ensure that there is no unnecessary transmission of the disease. Once again, Bluffland Whitetails, along with several other outdoor organizations throughout the state of Minnesota, are in support of Representative Eklund's bill, and I'll stand for any questions you might have. Thank you.
Members will take questions at the end of testimony. We have a number of testifiers. Craig Anwald with the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, welcome and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Craig Engwall. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, and I am here to testify on behalf of our membership in support of Representative Eklund's bill. MDHA just held our 43rd annual meeting on Saturday, where we had hundreds of members come together with leaders of 50 of our chapters to go over a number of our policy positions. And as one might suspect, CWD was at the top of the list. We had overwhelming support for a number of measures to protect the wild deer herd, and at the top of the list was a discussion of this very test, the RT Quick test, and what benefits it could offer. It's a relatively inexpensive test that can help shape the way servant farming is regulated in Minnesota and protect our wild deer herd. And We feel that once this test is approved by USDA, it should be widely implemented to test the servant, captive servant herd, to protect, which would offer additional protection for the wild deer herd. So in looking at all the issues in CWD, obviously there have been a number of things that have happened over the years, but one thing that hasn't happened is there hasn't been much change in the last 4 years since the legislative auditor's report came out examining oversight of the captive servant industry by the Board of Animal Health and how the industry operates. At that time, the legislative auditor found that approximately one-third of servant farms failed to have a sample of tissue for a postmortem test to determine whether the animals had chronic wasting disease as required by law. If you jump forward to today, on February 1st, the DNR and the Board of Animal Health released their joint report to the legislature that found that there still is a 34% infraction rate of farms that they inspected. And these were not merely minor infractions. These range from fence issues to other things. We've also recently seen egregious violations of law, like those of the Beltrami County farmer who brought CWD-infected animals from Winona County up to Beltrami County, illegally disposed of CWD-infected carcasses on public lands. And we all are paying the price for that now with an exclusionary fence that costs nearly $200,000, as well as surveillance that will cost millions of dollars going forward. So to close, Mr. Chair and members, we can't allow the situation to continue to go unchecked, and we think the bill proposed by Representative Eklund is a strong step forward to protect our wild deer herd, and we ask your support, and I will stand for questions at the end of the hearing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, Dr. Jerry Torreson, University of Minnesota. Welcome, Dr. Torreson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Jerry Torreson. I'm the director of the University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. First, I'd like to emphasize that the RT-QuIC test is widely regarded, as has been said, as an excellent step forward in diagnostics for transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, including CWD. Other veterinary diagnostic laboratories participating in the USDA validation process have expressed positive comments about the performance of the test and the work being done in the MinPro lab at the university to advance the test validation. But right now, I'm here to explain some details about how testing works in USDA networked laboratories and how the timing of the implementation of the RT-QuIC test now could affect our testing for USDA. The University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is part of a National Animal Health Laboratory Network with USDA, also known as NALM, comprised of 59 veterinary diagnostic labs throughout the U.S. The NALM supports U.S. animal agriculture by developing and increasing the capabilities and capacities of a National Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory Network to support early detection, rapid response, and appropriate recovery from high-consequence animal diseases. Minnesota tests for 10 of the 14 program diseases affecting cattle, poultry, pigs, sheep, goats, and cervids. Testing for any of these program diseases requires an official, standardized, and approved diagnostic test. As a non-lab, as a member of this network, we are limited to using approved, fully validated, and standardized tests for program diseases to ensure ongoing confidence in and international recognition of the results reported from any laboratory in the network. I asked for guidance from USDA on how we could implement the RT-QuIC test at this time here in our laboratory by securing a variance from these requirements. I received a letter on February 14th from the Chief Veterinary Officer of the U.S., Dr. Rosemary Sifford, indicating that any use of an unofficial test would result in action by USDA, quote, to address what is considered outside the standard expectations of the known, end quote. In summary, any unofficial testing of a program disease, even if it has been shown to be highly accurate and beneficial, is viewed as a breach of our contract with USDA and could threaten our ability to provide testing for all program diseases, including such threats as high path avian influenza and African swine fever. We will certainly continue to advocate for rapid validation of and pursue avenues for using the RT-QuIC test at the VDL, but this is the status as of today.
Tony Quillis, Elk Readers Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tony Quillis, and I'm representing the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association today. And thank you for the opportunity to make a couple of comments on House File 2814. Mr. Chairman, in regards to Section 1 in the required soil test, we appreciate the language pertaining to the soil test requires a testing method approved by the board. But as you just heard, there is not an approved or validated soil test at the state or federal level. Another concern is that we appear to be singling out just one infectious disease. There are other infectious diseases, and these do not have the requirements that are put forth in Section 1 on them. Finally, Mr. Chairman, we're concerned that recording with the county recorder or register of titles a notice of CWD detection on the property, especially if the herd owner has completed all the land and time requirements. The concern is that landowners on which CWD positive wild deer are harvested, they're not required to record with county recorder or register a notice of previous CWD detection on their private property. Mr. Chairman, before I jump to Section 2 real quick, I think I wanted to note that there is a letter in your packets from the Minnesota Rulers also regarding some concerns on this section. In Section 2, Mr. Chairman, I realize that this is dealing with the white-tailed deer, but just wanted to also point out that express our concerns that there are no state or federal approved live tests for CWD. And if we're going to be making regulatory decisions, Mr. Chairman, we want to ensure that any testing requirement is validated, scientifically approved, and peer-reviewed, and based on methods that are not and that are standardized. And finally, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to wrap up. I wanted on the record that the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association is very supportive of the University of Minnesota and Dr. Peter Larson and what he's been doing over there. He has been doing a great job. We've been involved with him, and we're very supportive of where he's going with live testing. But I just wanted to end with, Mr. Chairman, there has nothing been validated or approved on the state level or federal level in these regards. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for allowing me to express my concerns today about House File 2814, and happy birthday.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. Dave Carlson, Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Dave Carlson, president of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. We're an organization representing over 50 groups across the state and advocate for the sportsmen and sportswomen's interests in many areas. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 2814, and I want to thank Representative Eklund for bringing this legislation forward. Just a little background about CWD from our perspective. CWD has been an issue of great interest to sportsmen and women, and especially deer hunters, for many years. Deer hunting is a treasured outdoor heritage for many, and the protection of the wild deer herd in Minnesota is of utmost importance. Since CWD was discovered in Minnesota, there has not been enough of an effort to eradicate the disease and protect our wild deer herd. A report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor in 2018 did not shed a bright light about how CWD had been managed and enforced by the Board of Animal Health, with cases failing to submit tissue samples for CWD testing, defencing violations, and there was evidence of cervid farmers not following the rules. The case from last summer in Beltrami County was another serious instance of disregard for the rules and just a lack of common sense. Initially, 13 deer were tested positive for CWD. During the investigation, it was discovered that the herd owner disposed infected carcasses on county land. The herd owner violated quarantine by moving carcasses off of his farm with the Board of Animal Health permission. In all, 19 positive deer carcasses were confirmed in this area. On February 1st, in the report from the DNR about concurrent management, it was reported that 30% of the farms inspected for the report had violations, including 10 farms with inadequate fencing, 2 herd owners' failure to submit death reports in the required time frame, and 1 herd owner failure to submit samples for CWD testing. This was alarming to deer hunters, and we demand that information like this leads to better management and enforcement of servant farms and herd owners. Deer hunters have loudly called for more legislation to protect our wild deer for a long time. Since 2018, those calls have become louder. Although good legislation has been introduced and heard, not much has been passed. House File 2814 is a good bill and a start to provide live testing for farm deer. And this bill funds those tests. Deer hunters support this legislation and ask for more common sense legislation to protect the wild deer herd of Minnesota and help leave a legacy for the deer hunting tradition in our great state. And we support House File 2814. Thank you.
Jim Spreck, Minnesota Deer Farmers Association.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Tim Spreck. I'm speaking today for the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association. Appreciate the opportunity to comment on House File 2814 on behalf of the deer farmers. Mr. Chair, on line 2.2 to 2.4, where we address soil testing, it's important to understand and to underline that the technology, although encouraging, is not there yet today. It's in its infancy. If you recall, Mr. Chair, a couple weeks ago in the Ag Committee when this bill was heard, we heard expert testimony from Dr. Henderson, who is a pioneer and has been working in the RT Quick field for many, many years, and his comments were supportive of the point I'm making today. This technology is not there yet. It could be there. It has encouraging results, but it's just not there yet, Mr. Chair. And in a situation where we're looking to potentially in a technology that could cause someone to have to be forced out of business because of a false positive or an inability to correctly assess the situation, we want to urge great caution and especially in this area. Mr. Chair, on line 2.5 to 2.8, what we've got here essentially is a deed restriction that would be recorded at the county recorder's office. Mr. Chair, Minnesota tends to rely more on disclosure rather than deed restrictions. It would be incumbent on a property owner to disclose this at the time of sale. That's more than sufficient to make sure that any potential purchaser of the property down the line would be fully aware of what they were buying. Line 2.11 to 2.16, live animal testing. Once again, we should go back to and highlight the comments that Dr. Torreson just made. USDA is very adamant about this. You should all have the letter in your packet to review for yourself. USDA has not approved RT Quick technology, even though it is encouraging. And Dr. Torreson stated it very simply that if we do rely and we do use this technology, we would be in violation and there could be consequences. And further, Mr. Chair, down at the bottom of the bill where it indicates an October 2022 deadline for implementation and to have all of this completed. It's just not enough time to get this done. We need to develop enough tests. We need to administer and evaluate the results. And it's just something that needs to really be considered in terms of workability. Mr. Chair, as long as we do have a minute or so left, I'd like to address comments that have been made about the Beltrami farmer situation. You would have received from the Minnesota Deer Farmers, as did most people, committee chairs and members of the press, a letter that was submitted by the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association when this became public. We did condemn this, and we do believe that if there is a bad actor, they should be dealt with accordingly. And I think in this case, please don't paint the entire industry with a broad brush based on the mistakes that were made by one of the actors. And also one more point, Mr. Chair, it's been widely reported in the press and has been recounted numerous times, including this afternoon as well, that the Winona County farm that sold deer to the Beltrami farm was CWD positive. Mr. Chair, that is absolutely incorrect. That farm has had a number of deer tested. None were positive. And I think we need to correct the record. And if we intend to have an intellectual and honest debate about this topic, we need to make sure that we're all factually correct. And with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for the time.
Thank you. Brad Gausman, Minnesota Conservation Federation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak this afternoon. My name is Brad Gausman, and I speak today as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservation Federation and on behalf of the Chronic Wasting Disease Action Coalition. The Minnesota Conservation Federation has been an advocate for the woods, waters, and wildlife in Minnesota since 1936. The CWD Action Coalition is a coalition of organizations who are working to maintain the health of Minnesota's wild cervid animals. Our coalition includes statewide and national organizations representing the supporting public and conservation interests. The spread of CWD across our state presents an imminent threat to our state's cervid animals, including white-tailed deer. Our strong deer hunting culture and an annual $500 million economy built on deer hunting. The role of captive cervid facilities and the spread of CWD cannot be denied. Traceouts of cervid animal movements provide a roadmap for the spread of this disease across our state. It was determined that in Beltrami County, a farm there had was found to be CWD positive and had moved animals from that facility to other facilities in Minnesota, endangering both captive and wild deer. At the present time, two state agencies have been given concurrent authority over captive cervid animals. From reviewing the Minnesota DNR and Board of Animal Health report, concurrent authority regulating farmed white-tailed deer, it is clear that urgent action is necessary to protect the health of wild deer in Minnesota. Rates of fencing infractions witnessed by agency officials and detailed in the report are simply unacceptable. The report also highlights that nationwide, even cervid farms that meet the highest USDA standards for herd certification were still found to be spreading CWD. The report states that most of the herds discovered to have CWD in the United States in the past 5 years have been level 6, which is the highest level of certification, at the time of disease discovery. Researchers in Minnesota have developed the RT-Quick test, which can be used in an antemortem state. Up until recently, reliable methods have only been available for testing deceased animals. This test has been shown to be very reliable in detecting the presence of the disease in living cervid animals. The use of RT-Quick to test all captive cervids in Minnesota, as described in HF 2814, is a step in the right direction as we seek to fully understand the prevalence of the disease in captive cervids in Minnesota. Now is the time to realize the benefits of the funding and work that have gone into developing the RT-Quick test for chronic wasting disease. There is little, if any, time to waste as we seek to stop the spread of CWD. The CWD Action Coalition supports the passage of HF 2814 and also urges this committee to continue its work towards protecting our state's wild deer and cervid animals. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question for Mr. Sprack, if he'd be willing to just to take on a question here related to his association.
Mr. Sprack.
Can you talk about what the association is doing to encourage farmers to follow the law? I think we saw in the report that came out that a few other people have mentioned that we had a number of compliance infractions. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what your association is doing to encourage that. And going forward, if there are changes to the law, what sort of communication and work you're doing on that issue. I'd love to hear that from you. Thank you.
Mr. Sprague.
Thank you. I appreciate that question and having the opportunity to add some additional information on behalf of the organization. So the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association is a professional group of full-time livestock farmers. They take this very seriously. Nobody wants CWD on their property, and they go to all the lengths that they possibly can to make sure that they're obeying the laws. Now, with regard to this 30% infraction rate, I have not had an opportunity to review, and I don't believe any of us have had an opportunity to review what these infractions are. Are they minor nitpicking situations? Are they egregious? We don't know. Fencing violations could be anything from snowdrift up against the fence, causing it not to be full height when measured. Could be storm damage, could be any number of things. So we really need to drill down and find out what these are. And if there are egregious violations, the organization will certainly work to get the information out and to make sure that people are within compliance. We don't need any kind of a black eye on the industry. Some of the other things that I was told by a couple of the operators that they were given, I don't know if it was an official citation, but they were chastised for having a watering station too close to the fence. This is not a violation because this is not something that's addressed within rule or in statute. So if there's a situation where a watering station is too close to the fence, we need to be made aware that that is something that potentially could cause a problem so that we can correct these situations. So I think with regard to the violations, number one, we don't know what they are and whether or not they're egregious. And oftentimes the information is not disseminated properly so that the farmers actually understand what is required of them. So I think we can do more work. But the Deer Farmers Association would do everything in their power to make sure that people are in compliance. That is their goal.
Members, we've got about 15 minutes left. What I'm going to do is have each of the members with their hands up ask their question and to see if we have a little bit of time for response. If not, then we'll move to the tourism. I do want to get the tourism bill done. So Representative Eklund, then Representative Heinzman, Representative Becker-Finn, and then Representative Lurick. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, I have not heard anything from the county recorders as of yet as far as registering a title, but I did hear Mr. Spreck say that he was in favor of full disclosure on CWD positive farms. I just want him to confirm that.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question and then some comments, but maybe Representative Eklund could help me out. I heard some testimony on lines 2.2 through 2.4, and that's raising a lot of questions for a lot of people, Representative Eklund. There's, of course, the test itself, which I think Dr. Peter Larson does deserve a hell of a lot of credit for what he has done and his team at the University of Minnesota developing this test. And I want to believe that it's there, you know, like the rest of, I think, the entire country. But at the same time, is there some kind of research that has been done, some peer-reviewed work that we could refer to support the idea that we would be testing soil and then how that would be handled? It does seem like even though we're seeing super positive preliminary results as it relates to RT-Quick, this might be a little bit ahead of the curve. And I'd just like to know what you looked at specifically, Representative, to try and develop that language, because I haven't seen it yet, but maybe it's something you can share with the committee.
Representative Heinzman, we were going to have Peter Larson with us today, but all of the researchers are in Texas at a CWD conference. And so we're laying the bill over rather than moving it. I think it would be great if, we expect to have him probably next week, and we would bring this bill back up again so we can have further discussion on these questions if we can get the questions asked, if that's okay for you.
Mr. Chair, that would be probably very helpful because there's a lot missing today in the presentation, unfortunately, not to knock Representative Eklund in any way or disparage him in any way, but there's so many questions, and unfortunately, we're not going to have the time to get them answered by the sound of it. So bringing the bill back seems like that would make the most sense. Yep. And give us another bite at the apple. Just another comment, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, and I will yield my time. We've heard over and over from testifiers today, Mr. Chair, that this is a step in the right direction. And that may be the case. We can still, I think, have an opportunity to debate that as it might come to light that there's some things here that might not be a step in the right direction. As you know, Mr. Chair, you and I have been dialoguing, but the rest of the committee hasn't been a part of that. My caucus is fully committed to that, to working on not just a step in the right direction, but potentially a solution that everybody could agree on. And I've introduced legislation that would move in the direction of an option for buyout that would eliminate permits or stop permits from continuing to be issued for more deer farms. And I think that it's a better solution as opposed to the idea of, and I'm going to be somewhat aggressive in my comment, but it seems as though the DFL's approach to this has been to regulate these businesses into bankruptcy. And I'm not going to assume that anybody's intent, but it is going to have that effect if we continue forward this way. It seems that a buyout would be a better solution. So people who have invested their life's energy into this legal form of agriculture, technically, would be able to transition into a different business model. And so I hope that the chair and some of the groups would look closely at that. I've asked for a hearing on this bill. I hope that maybe that could start a conversation that would be more productive than what we've currently had. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Heinzman, you know, this bill came from ag because of the language with it being an act relating to animal health. Next week, my moratorium bill will be heard in ag, and I would expect if it passes, it comes here. Members, I hate to do this, but I do want to get that bill passed. This bill is being laid over because we'll be bringing it back up again, and I just need to get us done here. So I'm going to lay the bill over. Vice Chair Wasilek, if you could take the gavel and bring up House File 3616.
Yep, I will do that. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will move House File 3616 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Hansen, you also have an author's amendment. Representative Hansen, will you move the A1 amendment and explain it to us briefly?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A1 amendment. What that does is it increases the amount appropriated in the bill that we heard last week from $6 million to $10 million. It includes tribal governments, as we discussed, and then it provides for the randomization procedure that we did with agriculture and DNR. I would ask for your support.
Representative Hansen moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Say nay. The amendment is.
Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I would move the A2 amendment, which provides a carve out of $250,000 for important.
Chair Hansen moves the A2 amendment. Any questions or discussions to the A2 amendment? And members, this was actually mine until I had to take over as chair. So just in case, Representative Igo.
I'm back, Representative Eklund, if you want me to take over.
Representative Wasilek is back. You can have the chair.
All right.
Gavel, Madam Chair.
Yes, I see questions from Representative Igoe and Representative Lewick.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. So my quick question was just about this amendment. Is it just for where did the earmark come from? Because if we're talking about border communities, you know, we could have talked about Crane Lake, then International Falls, I mean, even Ely, War Road, Roseau, all up and down the north. So I just, is there a little background to the to this amendment?
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Igoe, there we have a border relief community bill that's also out there that's looking for a deed grant program. The reason we put this carve out in for Grand Portage is because 90% of their business comes from the Canadian side, and with the border being shut down for 2 years, they are struggling greatly.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a little further inquiry on that line. So, as I understand it, this would be exclusively dedicated to the tribal government there to run their own grant program. Is there any opportunity for the local business community that's not part of that tribal government or their corporate arm to participate in that, or are they locked out of that? Is it strictly tribal corporate? You would see we got some small communities up there, small chambers of commerce that also heavily depend on that tourism from Canada. So is this only this group and nobody else, or what's the story on that?
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lewick, this is a carve out for Grand Portage alone. As I explained to Representative Igoe earlier, we have a bill that's traveling both in the House and the Senate that is called the Border Community Relief Program. It'll be a deed administered program where those businesses will be able to apply for grants through there.
Quick, do you have any concept of how much, how many dollars are going to be available? And so would that give Grand Marais and some of those small up there an opportunity to match $250,000?
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Representative Wozlik. And like I said, this is a different bill, but I don't have it in front of me, but I believe the max is $50,000 the businesses can get, and it'll be dependent on showing their profit loss from 2019 to 2022.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, so since I froze, and Representative Heintzman.
Yeah, just an additional question, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Yep, quickly, Representative Heintzman.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Eklund, I did just want a further clarification. You're pointing out that there's another bill traveling, and so I think that's been brought into the discussion, and I probably need to get more information on that. But my question specifically relative to what you're trying to do here would be to point out that it would be, I think, an opportunity for everyone in the region to apply for those dollars. And I'm trying to understand what you're up to here in carving it out in a way that seems a little bit out of the ordinary. And I just want you to confirm for us, Representative Eklund, now, if there was an additional amount of money available, could not each and every tribal group in that region apply, even if it wasn't earmarked in the way that you are doing so in this language?
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Heintzman, the Grand Portage Band is the only one in the region that is strictly dealing on the Canadian border. And like I said earlier, 90% of their business is Canadian traffic. So I do not believe that Waste Fort, which also is in my district, would even consider looking at this.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
All right. So I guess our objection to this is that it seems like it would make more sense that if we really believe in the process at Explore Minnesota, and that in those situations where there is a need, such as is what Representative Eklund is describing, that process would work. And I think it casts somewhat of a shadow on what Explore and their process does and how well they manage those dollars. And maybe there's a whole nother discussion that we need to be having, Representative Eklund, because my understanding is that process has worked pretty well. And a carve out like this brings up some hard questions. And there's probably gonna have to be a larger discussion going forward if we don't have confidence in the current processes that are there to help communities and to help tribal governments inside those areas in that region of the state that you're looking to help. If the process wouldn't be to their benefit as it currently stands, then they probably need, like I said, to have a broader conversation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, we have to move on. We are at time here, so we are going to vote on the A2 amendment. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
The amendment is adopted. We are going to move on. Representative Hansen, any closing remarks?
I move that House File 3616 as amended be recommended be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 3616 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll on the bill.
All right. Vice Chair Wasilek?
Wasilek, aye.
Wasilek, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Aye. Representative Heintzman?
No opportunity for really any discussion. No.
Heintzman votes no. Representative Acomb?
Aye.
Acomb votes aye. Representative Eklund?
Eklund, no.
Eklund votes no. Representative Backer?
I'm sorry. Eklund changes to yes.
Eklund votes aye. Representative Backer? Representative Backer? Representative Becker Finn?
Aye.
Becker Finn votes aye. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund votes aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher votes aye. Representative Green?
No.
Green votes no. Representative Igo?
Igo, aye.
Igo votes aye. Representative Jordan?
Jordan, aye.
Jordan votes aye. Representative Keeler?
Keeler, aye.
Keeler votes aye. Representative Lee?
Lee, aye.
Lee votes aye. Representative Lippert?
Lippert, aye.
Lippert votes aye. Representative Lewick?
Lewick votes no.
Lewick votes no. Representative Morrison?
Morrison, aye.
Morrison votes aye. Representative Nelson?
Nelson votes no.
Nelson votes no. Representative Tice?
Tice votes no.
Tice votes no. Checking one more time for Representative Backer. All right. Madam Chair, the vote is 13 aye and 5 nay.
With that, the motion prevails. The bill is on its way to Ways and Means, and we are adjourned.